So, I've bought a new car.
Have you? New?
No, not new. No,
Ah,
new
okay.
to me, but still
Yeah.
way more than I've ever spent on anything other than a house.
Oh,
Yeah.
yeah. No, it's frightening, isn't it?
It is. Anyway, the thing is also, all my life I've driven old bangers, really,
Yeah.
or
Yeah, I know.
older
Yeah.
cars.
Yeah, for sure.
But this one is quite new, you see, and it has all this stuff in that I don't really understand, but I didn't want to appear an idiot.
No.
So when I picked it up, I had test driven it, but when I
Yeah.
picked it up, and the guy said, "Do you want me to run through anything more with you?" I said, "No, obviously, I'll just we'll sort it out." And I then sat outside for about 5 minutes because I couldn't work out how to turn it on.
You are officially old.
I mean, I was pressing the
Congratulations.
button, but I didn't realize you had to put your foot on the brake and all that. Anyway, I got it going, but it's still quite scary.
Well, if you can still remember how to start the podcast, that would be great.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 288 of the Midfaith Crisis
Nearly
podcast.
as old as you are.
We should do it more like Top Gear, given that opening, shouldn't we? Anyway, so here we are, episode 288. My name is Nick Page, and there is Captain Slow Joe Davis.
I know how to get a car going.
Yeah. Honestly, what's wrong with a key? You turned a key. Press a stupid button.
Anyway, other than
Anyway,
that, how is the car? What is the car? Are we allowed to say?
it's a Mini,
Oh,
but the
nice.
car I can't remember the make. Thank you very much. 1970s joke. Yeah, no, it's fine. I don't want to talk about it. It's too embarrassing, expensive, and I'm
Okay.
too scared of the thing. It looks nice, but anyway, listen, I've got actual church notices here.
Hooray! Well, come along then.
So I am speaking at an event, which is quite a rarity for me these days, the St Andrews Literature Festival. So it's an event about Christian authors,
Nice.
Christian books, and I have to say, some of the people there look much better than me, so I would go and listen to them. But I'm there on the 22nd of June
Great.
at, I can't remember when, 2 o'clock, I think, 2 o'clock, yeah.
And where is this event?
It's at Great Missenden.
Is that in the UK?
Yes, it is. It's in Buckinghamshire.
Okay.
Anyway, and I'll be speaking about a nearly infallible history of Christianity. I can't remember the name of the book, let alone anything in it. So that should be
I think you've
a
really
hideous
sold
ordeal.
that. Yeah,
Yeah.
well done. I can
Good.
see why
Thank you
you're
very
so good at
much.
marketing.
Yeah. Anyway, 22nd of June, come and say hello.
Great.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, that's a good church notice. Also, you've got matters arising. You have added
Yes.
something into the running order. What is this?
Yes, well, I think we should do matters arising, which is like things, it's a sort of what we didn't mention last time. And some of that we'll talk about a bit later when we talk about churches again. But you plucked the numbers reference out
I
of.
genuinely did.
I mean, it's just such a joyous thing. Numbers 4,
Verse
11.
11, yeah.
And it has. It turned out to be badgers. Well, that's the authorized version. It said
Okay.
you must cover the altar with skin of badgers or something,
Yes,
or the
yeah.
tabernacle.
Very
Can't
appropriate for
remember.
Nature Church.
Well, exactly. But the interesting thing is that Hebrew word is, I think it's takash, and nobody really knows what it means.
Oh, okay.
And so if you look at other translations of it,
Yeah.
they translate it as goat skin or, more excitingly, porpoise.
Coming with porpoise skin. That seems
Yeah.
odd.
Well, the best one is one that translates it as manatee, a sea cow, a dugong, which I think, I mean, where are you going to get a manatee skin in the middle of the desert?
Exactly.
You can imagine these two people have been, this family have been lugging some manatee skin around for years ago. Now, this is our moment. This is Anybody got any pauper skin out there?
I think it's more likely the writer of Numbers had a sideline in manatee skins.
Yeah, exactly. He'd got a job lot of dolphin he's trying to sell off.
Now, I know this seems obscure, but cover the altar in manatees, saith the Lord.
Also, I've got some lovely pine to make the poles with.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was beautiful to go then. It illustrates quite a lot of what we think of, we discover about the scriptures, is that quite a lot of the words are a bit obscure, to say the least. Anyway, so that was joyous. How are you? Should we come on to how are you? Because you are genuinely, you've got some genuine illness news, haven't you?
Well, it turns out my man cold was COVID. And that's why I had such a blooming headache all week. The funny thing is, no one knows whether they got COVID anymore. But we had arranged for months this lovely sacred pilgrimage to Minsmere with our dear friends. And it was going to be a little, you know, anniversary celebration as well, because it's our 40th wedding anniversary coming up. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, 40. Yeah, I know, right? So Rachel said, oh, man, I think we should test for COVID. And I said, no, don't. No one does that anymore. So anyway, she went and bought the tests, and we didn't want to go because the friend we were going with is actually vulnerable. I had spent a lot of time in hospital at one point. So sure enough, I mean, by the what was funny with Rachel, as she was putting the drops in, you know, by the second drop, it was positive. And so I said, oh, I suppose I better do it. And I was positive too. And then we got food poisoning on Sunday just to cap it all off. So I think between us, we are feeling quite miserable.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
But we're feeling better now. That's the good news.
The other good thing is you are vindicated, aren't you? So you genuinely were ill.
I don't know that COVID carries the power it used to, though, nor the sympathy, I'm sad to say.
Well, it certainly isn't as powerful as full-blown man flu. I think we all accept that.
We all agreed that's hospitalisation. End of. That's that. We feel weary. Have I mentioned I want a holiday?
No.
And I'm going on holiday.
Said a word about it.
No. Oh, dear. Oh, I've got a question for you. I've got one question and one comment for you, actually. Firstly, went to NEP on Sunday. Obviously, I was still positive, so I went early on my own. It was beautiful. Do you remember Sunday was sunny and gorgeous and hot and lovely and almost like summer? So here's my question. When Jesus said, where two or more are gathered in my name, there I am, was he referring exclusively to humans, or could he have meant earthlings? In which case, I could do a church for storks and rabbits, legitimately.
Well, I think that Jesus is with us wherever we are anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure about that. the necessity of two or more, either, even though you said it. It's an interesting question.
It is.
Actually.
So there we go.
I'm going to have to go away and think about that one, actually.
So this is an open invitation to any storks and rabbits out there, listeners. Church,
I would say storks and rabbits as church members are probably more easily manageable than humans, aren't they?
You're not going to have the level of problems you have with, let's say, the average organist. Apologies to organists, it's just a joke. Okay, you're lovely people. And then the other thing is just a comment. So here's what I've been thinking about as I've been processing grief and, you know, doing all that stuff you do. I've come up with what I think is the key to a happy life. So I'm just going to run this past you. This is semi-serious, by the way. I think the aim constantly is to set the bar lower and lower for joy. To experience joy. Like when you're young, you think, oh, this is going to make me happy if I have this, if I have that. And then, you know, around about midlife, you realise, oh, no, nothing can really make you happy or fill the void inside. You're in charge of that. You know, that's the whole midlife crisis, I suppose, as opposed to mid-faith crisis. Well, I'm starting to realise. I had a bit of an epiphany, if I'm honest.
Not another one.
I had an epiphany. This time I was sat in my garden. And I was sat out there on Sunday, having been to NEP, and I thought to myself, self, if you cannot be happy now, you can't ever be happy. You know, to have a wife that still sort of likes you after 40 years, family that still seem to like me, to have a clutch of good friends, to have a house to live in, to have a, you know, like I'm so wealthy, really, in that sense.
Mm.
I feel wealthy, really, even though I whinge about money a lot. But, you know, I am wealthy, I suppose, is the objective truth compared to most people in the world. So it just really set upon me that it's just so, and I'm not saying this in a self-deprecating way or, you know, self-loathing thing, because you can beat yourself up about this. I ought to be happy and I ought to be happy. Yeah. But it wasn't that tone of voice at all. It was just that real realisation that, my goodness, if you can't be happy now, what on earth would it take to make you happy? What do you think? What do you think you could possibly have more that will make you happy? So learn to be happy now. And you know, inevitably I've been thinking about death recently, and I wonder if the people who do the end of life well, and I've witnessed people doing the end of life well, have learned to be able to experience joy with less and less and less, even, you know, with very poor physical health and, you know, presumably less financially, and less, you know, that the whole art of life is to let go. Set the bar for joy lower and lower and lower. Anyway, that was the thought I was pondering. That might be a load of old rubbish, but it came to me quite strongly on Sunday.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in there. I'm not sure about setting the bar lower, lower and lower, because then you might end up in, you know, this is kind of like almost like Stockholm syndrome, where people are in terrible situations, but they're being told they should be joyful the whole time. So they kind of turn that into the norm.
Yeah, okay.
I think the problem is we often in life take our personal best and assume that is the norm. Mm. So this happens in sport. You know, I play squash every week, and some weeks I play really, really well. And my brain tells me that's what I should be able to do all the time. But actually, most weeks I play okay. And that is the norm. The okay is the norm, not the really, really well. So, you know, yeah. I think we often have these experiences and we think, well, life should be like that. Life yes. should be like our personal yes. best the whole yeah. time. Whereas if you could, what you seem to be doing there is coming to a realisation that the norm of joy is this. Here's what I need for the norm. You know, it's this kind of thing. It's this, there is nothing particularly going wrong with the house. So there is nothing. There
yeah,
is,
yeah.
Yeah, there are. I have enough food in the cupboards. I have friends. I have relationships.
Or even I'm breathing. I mean, that would be a good reason to feel joyful, yeah. wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, again, maybe a bit low, but you know, I think that is, you know, that's the thing. If you have a standard and you can measure anything against that, that might be quite helpful in those situations of life where everything is screaming at us, you are unhappy and you're, you know, life is a failure and it's awful for you. But you could turn around and go, well, hang on a minute. I've got this, I've got that. I've got the elements that I usually associate
yes.
with contentment, if not joy.
Well, maybe contentment and joyfulness are intrinsically linked. Because life is never a bowl of roses completely. There's no. always stuff. There's always problems. There's always hurdles to overcome. There's always issues to come. Generally, at this age, something aches somewhere. So, you know, there's always stuff going on. And I think the wrong way to do that is to constantly be thinking, well, I wish I had the health I had 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And, you know, that feeling, you know, just resentful and unhappy and comparing yourself to the younger version of yours you that was much more athletic. You know, is there a way to just unleash this kind of contentment with what is now? And I suppose this goes back to my theme last year of being, you know, showing up and being present. Well, what's wrong here? I was so aware at that moment, it sat in the garden, that though technically I had COVID, in a way, in that moment, there was nothing wrong. You know, I was alive and surrounded by, you know, flowers and birds and insects and breathing, and the sun was shining. And I suppose it's easy to feel good in that sense. You do have a sense of well-being, and I've just been to net. But I just thought, oh, yeah, actually, it would be very easy for me to be in my head thinking about how I'm going to conquer this coming week and, you know, how I'm going to deal with all the problems that are coming up. But actually, because I was alive to that moment, it made me realise I've got everything I need in this moment to feel content.
Contentment, I think, is really key. I mean, I love the biblical picture of, you know, what fulfillment and contentment is in things like Isaiah, where contentment is basically, you've got a roof over your head, you've got a vine to sit under, yeah. You know, you've got wine to drink and food on the table. Now, it's not that you're rich, you haven't necessarily got rich, you've got to do work, you've got to till the soil, you've got to do it, you've got to sell all those porpoise skins that you got extra, you've got to find manatees. A way to shift those.
Where do you store the manatees before you use the skin? There's a lot of issues.
And I mean, in the heat, they really are giving off a bit of a stench, but you know, you've got enough, you've got sufficient, and you've got sufficient of what makes you sort of content. And I do think it's all that stuff about living in the moment, about not projecting into the future. You know, that comes into it as well. But I like the idea of almost identifying a baseline,
yes,
of joy, to remind yourself. I don't think it'll stop me getting anxious. I don't think it'll stop me being unhappy, because there's stuff going on all the time that makes you do that way. But it might be a good anchor point.
You know,
to have that biblical picture, whatever that picture is for us. What's your picture of contentment?
Yeah, and to constantly be revisiting it and maybe seeing if you can take a few little bits out and still be content.
Well, just enjoy it while you're there, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Be grateful.
Anyway, we'll return to that, but thank you. I appreciate that.
That was a very long how are you.
I'm sorry. I waffled. I apologise. How are you?
That's all right. No, how it's you, interesting, mate? Isn't it? Yeah, I'm all right. I'm content. Let's just leave it there.
No.
I got a new car I can't turn on. I got. I'm going to the theatre this afternoon, actually.
Oh, that's why we're not recording it.
I'm going to a matinee. We have to go to a matinee now, because if we leave the dog in the evening and he gets upset and he barks, so we have to go out in the day.
Okay.
We've got this elderly relative we are caring for now, basically. So yeah,
but Bill is so lovely. He's such a lovely.
He's so lovely, but he can't really remember who he is or where he is now. So he fits in perfectly, pretty much. Yeah. I'm pretty good, really. I think we should move on, shouldn't we?
Okay. So this in from Sue, who says, "Dear Joe and Nick, this email comes with as much pith as I can muster." She says, "It's not something for which I'm particularly noted." She says, "I can understand why your listener might question Jesus's humility." She said, "As an Enneagram 2, I need to be aware of pride in myself and learn about humility and what it means to walk humbly. My wise spiritual director once helpfully pointed out to me that sometimes pride can seem like humility, and humility can look like and be interpreted as pride. I find this very helpful to keep in mind with regard to both my own behaviour and how I view other people's actions and words. Just wondered if this thought might help a little when thinking about Jesus and his humility." She says, "Thank you for the podcast and for giving a glimpse of the awful pain when church goes wrong, and for being prepared to risk going online to reach out to others who are confused and struggling on their journey." And that is from Sue. So, yeah. And look, should we move on to this other piece of feedback? Because it's on a similar thing. So this email, I'll keep it anonymous, but this is about Mike Pilavachi, who came back here. And he wants to point out that Mike Pilavachi actually lived a simple life. And then he said, "But Mike would often use self-deprecating stories about himself to show humility. But this was done on a stage environment in order to gain the affection of the audience. What does real humility look like in a leader?" He says,
Well, haven't we all done that? I mean, you know, that we all carefully curate the humiliation stories that we tell.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because, you know, on a stage, you're trying to make a connection with the audience. You're trying to say, "I'm like you," and you're trying to relax them. And often they're funny, and that's fine.
So a bit of self-deprecating humour
And it's cultural as well. I think the British, we don't trust anybody who takes themselves too seriously. You can't laugh at themselves.
Yeah, true.
We really don't like that. But I do think there is a level of sort of performative humility that you can accidentally slip into. I'm speaking for myself here, where you can sort of, you're aware that you are actually sort of performing this thing, and there's an irony that you're performing it while standing on a stage or standing at a lectern in front of a lot of other people.
Yeah,
you know, I think actually the real humility is in invisibility. It's doing stuff where nobody will see you.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody will know you had anything to do with it. Making something but not getting the credit for it. You know, that kind of thing. I think that's humble.
I always think that secrecy is one of the most powerful spiritual disciplines, to do stuff and to ensure that no one knows, whether it's giving, whether it is serving, whether it's just doing something but not making a song and dance of it. And, you know, if you're helping someone or giving something, you know, if you can do it anonymously, to do it anonymously and not to tell anyone about it. I think it changes us in a really positive and good way. I mean, because if I'm going to be humble, I want other people to know about it. Thank you.
Exactly. You know, and this is one of the reasons why I don't really do any speaking as I used to do, you know, different churches and different places. It's because I think that community matters, and in your community, they should know you. You know, so you can't fake it, or it's harder to fake it in your community. You know, sometimes, sadly, as we've seen, it's harder to call it out as well. But, you know, that's the thing. A real community, a Christian community, should know you for who you are. And therefore, it's easier to be vulnerable, to be open, and not to have to perform humility, really.
Okay. I think just to go back to the start of that email, he was trying to say positively, Mike Pilavachi lived a simple life. Because I think when we originally talked about it, you were making a point that, you know, these organisations that are built around leaders then become big money machines. But that doesn't mean the person at the head of it is raking off a load of money.
No. Thank you. I think that's really important. I didn't know, and I had no reason to assume that was the case. I think it is the organisation, it's the machine. And sometimes I think the leaders themselves are as trapped as anyone else.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of have to keep it going. I remember years ago working at Oasis and talking to Steve one day and him going, you know, we've got 50 staff now. You know, and him feeling the responsibility of keeping people like you employed.
Yes, I know.
I mean, what a dreadful responsibility that
awesome.
Is. Where else were you going to get a job? And no, you know, so I think kudos. I'm sure that you know, he was not getting a lot of money from this, but the organization was a big machine.
Okay, good. Right, well, let's move on. Again, I'm going to keep this one anonymous as well. I've edited this one around a little bit. But this one says, "Hi, lovely people," meaning you and me, interestingly.
Oh.
So poor judge of character. he says, I'm an ordained Anglican minister. And then he talked for a bit and he said, "The next bit is not a criticism of you, podcast or listeners." He says, "It's a reflection on my own reactions. Sometimes I hear what you or your listeners say about church. I think especially about what people say about what they expect, want or need from church, or difficult experiences they've had with church. I hear those and sometimes I recognise some of those things described and think, were they talking about my leadership? That sounds like how I used to be or am. And that's a cause for sadness for me to reflect on and work on. But I also sometimes think, come on, I know we make mistakes as leaders and those need to be worked on, but we're trying to work it out too. Cut us some slack. I was trying my best. Everything is only ever a work in progress, which doesn't excuse a lot of the wrong things, but maybe just understand that leaders are learning too. Then I think about what I've experienced. Bullying towards me by one particular leader I worked with, whose surname is well known in some UK church circles, it drove me to near suicide. His bullying was, it turns out, an open secret. Just no one thought to tell me before I worked with him. He's still working in the church. I think also of the things I've been unjustly and baselessly accused of in leadership, the bullying and nastiness church members have exhibited towards me, which has also driven me close to suicide. Sometimes I wish some church members would email your show and say sorry for things they've said or done to leaders, or maybe they have, before I started listening. He said, I have good therapy and I try to work through stuff. And he finishes with, I may sound bitter. I'm really not. I still love God. I still love what the church can be. I just wish we could give each other the benefit of the doubt a bit more sometimes. Grace and peace. And we'll keep that one anonymous. But that is a lovely email, isn't it? And perhaps, you know, this is an opportunity to say again, which we have said many times, many of our dear friends are clergy. They work in the church. They work tirelessly. They often suffer a lot of discouragement. And we talk about the church, and yeah, we're on that sort of deconstruction journey, but we always try to be positive and affirming of those people who work so hard. So, you know, sorry if we've ever not come across that way.
I think that's really a wonderful email, and you know what it shows is it's so wise and kind, and I think a really important reminder for us that it cuts both ways.
Yeah.
Do you remember us doing power whinging? Do you remember that years ago?
There was a craze of power, all sorts of things in the Wimber-esque times we lived in.
So there's power evangelism and power worship. And I remember...
Power healing.
And we did a thing on stage where you played a character called Pete Bollard, who was a church leader, who was into power whinging. And the idea was that you would go home and just whinge about things. And that would be, you know...
The powerful way.
God's power at work. And I just think that's we tend to do that. We tend to sort of not give people the benefit of the doubt. We tend to not think about what else they've got going on in their lives or what else is even happening that day. I love just the ending of that email. I still love God. Mm. I still love what church can be. I just wish we could give each other the benefit of the doubt a bit more. And isn't that a great thing? Just to go out from here and give each other the benefit of the doubt, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what your perspective is on this, because throughout the two of us, have real experience of what it's like to engage with church members in this way, I suppose.
Well, yes. I mean, I have certainly experienced the bullying of other church leaders. Not so much, I think, because I was never really the big senior head honcho. I never got the direct nastiness. I had some very inappropriate comments made to me, but never the real nastiness that often was reserved for the senior leader in a church meeting or in a nasty email. Yeah, there's just, you know, if you are trying to follow Jesus, where do you think you get off on being cruel and name calling and, you know, using your power for real nastiness? That's just not part of the deal. As we have talked about often, about how do we disagree well? You know, it's not that we all have to agree all the time, and that's never going to happen in community. But there has to be some values around love and kindness, doesn't there, if we're following Jesus? I don't know. So, yeah, it hurts, this stuff. It really hurts. And you know, we do have friends who are leaders, and I look on at some of my friends and go, I don't know how you're still there. I just don't know how you still do it. With this level of criticism and abuse coming your way, how have you stuck it out? Because I bugged out 12 years ago, and I ain't no wild horses wouldn't drag me back. So I have nothing but respect for those leaders that hang on in there amidst great discouragement. And I also feel the hurt of, you know, all these stories that come out. I don't know whether you know, but Gerald Coates is sort of posthumously under investigation now. Here's another story coming out, and you know, your heart groans inside, regardless of whether it's true or not, just the reputation of the church is being dragged through the gutter again. And
well, I mean, let's be nice to clergy.
Yeah.
What can we go from here?
Why don't we declare Be Nice to Clergy Day?
Be Nice to Clergy Day. That'd be good.
Yeah.
Not on their day off, because they won't appreciate it then. Just do it on Sunday. Be nice to clergy. That'd be good.
Yeah. What's the date on Sunday? The 9th of June. There you go. Sunday the 9th is Be Nice to Clergy Day.
Excellent.
Okay. This is from Sam. It was a lovely, but it was not a pithy email. So he talked about Pentecost and church, and along the way he mentioned spiral dynamics. And anyway, good stuff. Good stuff. But he finishes by saying this. I recognise that strong desire in me to be in a recognisable, structured, spiritually aligned community. It's nicer for sure, but I wonder if Jesus ever intended this. He seems to be pointing to a community that constantly effaces its own boundaries. I think it's incredibly difficult for what we understand and experience as the church today and through history to embody that. I think as we discover more about the wonder of nature, what we're seeing is the deep abiding community of things, from the subatomic to the intergalactic, to the astounding interconnected tapestry of life on our little planet. These days, I see following Christ more and more as leaning into that reality by whichever means. It can be quite lonely, though. So that's Sam talking about community, how difficult it is, and what did Jesus ever really mean by that community?
This is the constant tension, isn't it?
Mm.
All communities need some kind of structure, and they need some kind of identifiers about, you know, what makes them a community in the first place. Shared interests, shared ways of behaving, these kinds of things. This, I suppose, is what I was trying to get at last week. And I apologise if anything I said last week came across as sort of doctrinaire or kind of you must be this. It's really trying to get a definition of some of the sort of fundamental attributes of a church community in that sense. I ought to mention, actually, it's a great book by Rowan Williams called Being Christian, where he sort of boils it down to, I think it's Bible, Baptism, Eucharist and Prayer.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he kind of comes down to. And I mean, by Eucharist, of course, it's not a particularly formal way of doing things. Whatever you, however you want to do that commemorative meal, you know. So it's more about sort of definitions for me, about sort of what makes something a church as opposed to just getting together. So it was just ideas around that.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing is Jesus, what was Jesus intending to do? Was he intending to found the church as we have it? Or I would think almost entirely not, in a way, because of all the ways that it goes on. But he was, I think, founding community.
Yes.
I think he was doing that because discipleship is communal. That's its very nature. That was the expectation of it. And more to the point, we all need friends. You know, one of my favourite definitions of church or descriptions of church is the pursuit of God in the company of friends. So I think that's the whole community thing has to have some boundaries. But I accept what Sam was saying, that sometimes the boundaries become, prison bars rather than...
Yeah, I mean, could you gather community around the values of Jesus rather than beliefs about what constitutes a church?
Absolutely.
So my view is that people were to look at a community, people go, God, it's incredible how they love one another. I mean, that's what draws you to a community, love. And I think you see that love, it isn't there, but you're not drawn to the belief structure. You're not even necessarily drawn to what they actually do when they get together. It almost doesn't matter, but you are drawn to love in action, I think. Sometimes I think, you know, that there's that old cynical quote about where two or three are gathered, there's an argument. And sometimes I think, going back to that last email, sometimes we criticise the church for being, you know, hypocritical. You know, they're supposed to be all loving. But look at them. Look at the infighting. And I think, is that a church problem or is that just a human problem? You know, if the church wasn't the church, if it was groups of train spotters or, you know, some other collective group, would it not just be full of the same scandal and problems? Because that's human people are messy and broken and full of scandal, whatever their common interest is. And that includes those who are interested in following Jesus. And when you put them together, because they are in so many various stages of brokenness, of course you're going to get scandal and mess and, you know, arguments. You hope that the very nature of what it means to follow Jesus is here's a community of people who acknowledge and work on that stuff rather than try and cover it up or hide it or
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it is about discipleship, and I think that's maybe where church has gone wrong sometimes, in that it thinks it's about attendance. You know, we've often talked about the ABCs.
Yeah.
It's attendance, buildings and cash, but it's not about discipleship. It's not really about the first three, and it gets sucked into the kind of externals of that, but really, if you have a lot of people trying to follow Christ, it's actually quite hard. And yeah, it can cause really difficulties.
Yeah, you know, it's really hard.
Because if it's working at all, it's going to force you to face some things you might not want to face, really.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, from my years of pastor experience, you know, yeah, I understand people want to follow Jesus. I think they really do. But, you know, person A is trapped in a really unhappy marriage. Person B, they're really attracted to, you know, whether you're following Jesus or not, that's an issue. And if there's so much shame around that, you can't even talk about it. Probably the first thing you're going to know about is when person A has run off with person B and marriage is, you know, collapsed. And, you know, there's all sorts of scandal around. Wouldn't it have been maybe better to be in a community of, you know, saints and sinners that can just acknowledge that mix of, you know, stuff that is inside us? That's what.
Okay,
well, you mentioned the ABC and buildings and things. Kathy wrote it, right, and said, she said she was questioning basically the importance of place, as in a physical space or building, for the church. She says, up here in Cumbria, where we moved to quite recently, I see many groups that you would absolutely love, Joe, who are doing church outside, allowing the incredible beauty of nature to lead people to God and into worship. But on the other hand, there is also a network of C of E churches struggling with huge, beautiful buildings to maintain and dwindling elderly congregations. And yet within this network are some seeds of hope. And part of that hope seems to be to do with the rural sense of place. In these communities, they still see the church, as in building, as the place to go to find God, to find help, to find spiritual food. For me, as a primary school's church worker, it has been an extraordinary experience moving up here. 90%+ of my school are now church schools and are crying out for support with their spiritual curriculum. I have more invitations to help and support than I can possibly manage. Do you think what's happening here is just a decade or so behind what's happening down south in towns and cities? Or is there something to be said for a visible presence of the Christians in each community? Much love as always, Kathy.
Over the last few years, I've pretty much totally reconstructed my idea of place and the importance of spirituality of place and the importance to people of sacred places.
Yeah.
Whether that's your NEP for you
or
you know, a tiny 12th century church for me. You know, that's these places are places of connection. And therefore, I do think place is important, and I do think, personally, I think the church building is pretty important. It's not a god, and it shouldn't be sort of worshipped and treated in that way, as if nothing else mattered. And I think that's the problem. But you know, visibility, I think visibility is important. I think it does matter. You know, I think people have a spiritual yearning, and yes, I think they want to know what these places are. So where are they going to go?
Yeah, exactly. How will they find out? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my view is, and perhaps I haven't said this enough recently, is that we need all kinds of churches, including evangelical churches and, you know, liberal churches and buildings, cathedrals. You know, they can be brilliant, and small churches and house churches and visible churches and invisible and large and small. Large churches can do stuff that small churches can't do, and small churches can do things better than large. You need a variety of expressions. That said, I was never a fan of that idea of the homogenous unit principle, which the church growth people always used to talk about, which is where you grow a church of people who are basically homogenous, all the same. So you plant to a church for black Africans within a certain area, and you plant a church for, you know, wealthy, whatever, I don't know, tennis players, or, you know, the church grows. There is evidence that this is an effective way to grow churches, to make people, to do a church specifically for one type of person. But I've never thought that is right, even if it's effective, because you just think, but isn't one of the signs of the kingdom the diversity that slave and free, and men and women, and black and white, and they're all under the same. What else can bring communities together like Christ can? If you then separate them all out again into their homogenous groups, seems to me an important element of our humanity is missing, which is we are strong together in our diversity. And inclusion to me is a big part of the gospel.
I think one of the things we have to reimagine is the relationship between the community and the building in that sense. I mean, obviously, my mind's been very focused on this by writing the book about the history of churches, which I'm kind of looking at as a history of the sort of making of the British spiritual landscape in a way. That's, you know, these things are so fundamental to our outlook on life in so many ways. You know, it comes from our Christian heritage. I genuinely believe that. I'm not sort of knocking other religions. I'm just saying that historically it is really strongly the case. But I do think we have to now think about, well, how do we use these buildings? What do we do within them? I agree entirely what you're saying about whatever they were, homogenous unit prices. I don't know. Anyway, but I think to enable that to happen, to enable to break out of that, is you have to find different models of church that actually engage a wide range of people.
Yeah,
that's the other thing. Sure, if all you're interested in are optimizing the numbers to come to be in that place, then go homogenized. Yeah. You know, just do one thing that only serves one group of people, and then you'll attract them. But really, is that growing a discipleship community?
But it definitely works, and we can all think of churches that target young professionals. I mean, I'm not going to say who they are in London, and they pitch their music their way, and they pitch their subjects they talk about, and they pitch everything to attract that group, and it's very effective.
Well, as a young professional myself, I feel the attraction. I don't know about you.
As a young professional who can't switch their car on,
I would go if I could only work out how to work the car.
Right. So Robin says this. He says, hello. Good strong start, Robin. He says, is it wrong that, like Ant and Dec, I still can't tell who is Joe and who is Nick? Yeah, that's offensive.
It's very wrong. It's offensive. It's awful.
It's a very offensive start to the email. And then two, he says, a thought about what is church. He says, if we truly believe in inclusion, shouldn't at least some of our gatherings be open to everyone? I wonder if that's where the very informal versions are something different than church. P.S. he says, I find this very challenging because people who have different theology views and practices are very hard work. God bless Robin. So yeah, he's sort of really picking up on that point there, that if you break things down into just interest groups, and I guess that includes people who like looking at nature and stalks and stuff like that as well. If you're just doing it, where's the coming together of all these different sorts of people? That's a good point.
Well, I think it's a challenge, isn't it? And it kind of comes back to the boundaries and the things like that we were talking about, because you create this place which is visible so people know where to go. You put up notices say we're going to do it at this time so people know when to come.
Yeah.
And then that becomes a kind of trap. You have to do it there. Yeah. You have to do it at that time for the rest of eternity. You can't make changes.
Yeah.
And I think for you, in what you're trying to do, it's about, well, what do I want to this community to be? Do I actually want to found a community? You know, is that a fundamental thing? Is that what you want to do? But if you did, how would you make what you do more visible, and how would you make it inclusive? Now, I think actually what you're trying to do has such a huge opportunity to be much more inclusive.
Yes, I would hope so. Hey, listen, well, for example, Robin, how many storks and rabbits did you have at your last church?
Good question. What a good question.
You know, I mean, that's my criteria now.
Although I think you're getting a bit homogenous there with just, if you're just limiting it to storks and rabbits, what about the badgers? They're scared
prepared
to come,
allow in the odd fallow deer and badger. There you go. Although the badgers are going to be worried about their skins. I'm not going to lie.
Exactly. The badgers are going to come in, but they're never going to go out again, are they? They're going to be the altar. So listen, I all these things are start as helps, I think, and positive things, and then can easily turn into obstacles, hindrances. You know, they kind of solidify and stop movement. But yeah, we do want, surely we want people to feel that they can be included, to come in. So of course, you know, I think the aim for all of our communities is to be as inclusive as possible without losing a distinctive Christ-like discipleship identity. That's the challenge.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And the challenge for you is, you know, frankly, where are you going to get cash for upkeep of your services from a load of storks, badgers, herons, and assorted wildlife? You know,
Yes, it's a very good point.
It's the start of a cult. It's rubbish.
It can't be about the cash anymore.
No.
Yeah, you're right. And so speaking of cash,
yes,
let's just give out a massive thank you to everyone who supports the podcast.
Lovely segue.
Thank you. God bless you, dear people. Honestly, it means so much to us, and it's so encouraging through all the trials and tribulations of doing the podcast, including, may I say, Nick Page's equipment not working. Not mine not working, but Nick's not working. Mm, thank you.
Mm, I had a bit of equipment problem last night, but there you go. None of us are as young as we were. Thank you very much for listening and for supporting the podcast, for recommending it. We really do appreciate it. And we will be back with you next week. Well, I think I'd like to, you know what, I want to talk about next week. I want to talk about holidays.
Yes.
Because I don't think you've talked about that enough. And I also want to talk about Sabbath, because last Sunday, talking about appreciating clergy, I heard one of the best sermons I've ever heard in my life in a tiny little church, handful of people there, just really great. And I want to talk about it.
Okay, fair play. Look forward to it.
And in the meantime, of course, this Sunday, as we now know, is Be Kind to Clergy Day.
Don't they have a Buy a Vicar a Pint Day? I'm sure I've come across that before. But do you know what? Why not make every day Be Kind to Clergy Day? There's just a thought.
Be Kind to Everybody Day, come to that, really.
There's a thought.